Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Dr. Christopher Key Chapel, who is the Doshi Professor of Indic and Comparative Theology, and also the Director of the Master of Arts in Yoga Studies program at Loyola Marymount University. Chris, welcome back to the podcast.
Very good to be back again. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Today we get to talk about a fascinating publication that you edited, Yoga in Jainism. That may be a surprising title to some, but that's precisely why we have this broader brand of new books in Indian religions, so we can understand the whole gamut of what one thinks of as Hinduism versus Buddhism versus Jainism. And works like this really show the interplay of all of these traditions in the Indian subcontinent. So it really is a pleasure to be featuring this work at this time in the podcast. Do you want to tell us sort of how this project came about?
Yeah, I met Dr. Natmal Tatya both in terms of learning about his books, but also meeting him in person in the 1980s. And in his 1951 book, Studies in Jain Philosophy, he included a segment that I found absolutely fascinating about the practice of yoga within the Jain tradition. So I went to the LD Institute and found primary sources, started translating, and then gathered folks together on several occasions in India and in London to have conversations about how this tradition that we come to think of as Patanjali and then later Hatha Yoga, how this tradition has intersected with Jain tradition. And it was remarkable from a personal perspective that the overlay, and I remember having a conversation with none other than Dr. Gerald Larson many decades ago, and he said, really? What the Jains do in the Acharanga Sutra is the same thing that the yogis do with the practice of the yamas? And then the descriptions of karma are very Jain-like within Yoga Sutra. So we see clearly a borrowing from Patanjali, bringing in stuff from Jain practice. And then eventually we see an articulation of Jainism in a new way. And as recently as the 4th century, whenever they would use the word yoga, it was not a good thing. It would be about the stickiness of the karmas covering up the soul. And they were very specific that, no, we don't want yoga. We want a yoga. We want no yoga. And then the conversation shifted around the 6th century. And one of the very early Jain philosophers to include conversations employing the technical term yoga as spiritual practice was Haribhadra Virahanka, and he wrote a wonderful, beautiful text called The Yoga Bindu, in which he outlines how yoga must be seen as a universal endeavor. And he brings in the Buddhist perspectives, he brings in the Advaita Vedanta perspectives, he brings in the Jain perspectives, puts them in conversation, and bottom line says that the problem with the world, the problem with the human person, is that they are stuck due to unhealthy karmas. They need to release those karmas through whatever means. And it's really quite remarkable. In the sixth century's text, he gives details on how to retrieve past memories. He gives details on how to do dream work. He gives details about how to do puja, why to do puja, when to do puja. He gives very specific details on the recitation of mantra and the performance of japa, and lays out all of these avenues that result in the purification of karma. So this text, again, very early, not only for the Jain articulation of yoga, but it's also an early record of how religions were being practiced in day-to-day life in the sixth century in India. And then another Haribhadra comes along, and his name was Haribhadra Yakiniputra, a couple hundred years later. And he was responding with a little bit of distaste to the happenings in India vis-a-vis Tantra, and has a real trenchant critique of certain Tantric practices, as well as lining up the yoga Eightfold Path of Patanjali with correlate ideas from Gunastana language, which is the progressive 14-fold ladder toward freedom. And he also invokes Advaita Vedanta language vis-a-vis yoga, as well as Buddhist language vis-a-vis yoga. It's a fascinating text that offers one of the early doxographies, that is, roadmaps of how systems parallel one another and how they diverge from one another. And then a couple of centuries, two, three centuries later, we get another great scholar, also probably from Northwest India, called Hemachandra. And he writes this massive work. It's been translated by Uli Quanstrom, massive work called the Yoga Shastra, that again, step by step, goes through Patanjali, step by step says, yeah, this is how we do this in our tradition, and then introduces mantra and yantra meditative practices, borrowing in from another slightly earlier scholar called Shubhachandra, who wrote a text called the Gyanardava. And we find a full marriage of the internal meditations, the external behaviors, all in the name of yoga. So when these texts and these traditions became known to me, I began to meet with scholars, starting with Natmaltakya himself and so many others, gathering for conferences in India and in London as well. And the result was this edited volume that is just sort of pointing in the direction of the need for further research.
It really is a rich and fascinating work. And as I mentioned, really apropos the space we are creating on the podcast to convey this ecosystem, this Indic ecosystem, that really defies ultimate distinction along the lines through which we typically understand most of this religious phenomenon. For example, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, yoga, tantra. And so if you can give us sort of 30,000 foot view, you know, how do you understand, either through the lens of one of these figures or through the lens of presently on the ground, how do you understand the relationship between, for example, Hinduism, Jainism, yoga, or let's just say there's a listener in this podcast and they're like, hey, I was taught that yoga is one of the orthodox darshanas, one of the six, you know, true Hindu orthodox darshanas. And then wasn't Jainism one of those heterodox darshanas that broke away? And like, you know, everything Dr. Raj taught me in intro Hinduism was wrong. So what would you say to such a one?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And it's both sort of a classical historical question, and it remains a contemporary question. And there are perceptions and misperceptions, characterizations and mischaracterizations from so many different angles. And part of the reason why my own professorship is called, I'm the Doshi professor of Indic traditions, is because there are these permeable boundaries between traditions. And one really gets a sense that when what we call Hinduism arose, it was in full conversation. We know going all the way back to the Rig Veda, that there were vratyas, called out, people who took vows, who clearly had interesting lifestyles of total nudity, of not cutting their hair, and that these were other people, but that they were interesting, probably in a way that the Mughals later became interested, because they became fascinated with yogis and the peers, the Sufi saints and the yogis. We have beautiful paintings, miniature paintings from 400 or 500 years ago, of these people in conversation with one another. So without being soft in terms of wanting to overgeneralize, which is really never a good idea for a whole variety of reasons, I think it can be fairly clearly and accurately stated that there is this call to a supreme, to a transcendent, to what we might think of as param artha, which would be a higher sense of meaning or purpose, that can be used as a little bit of a roadmap or a diagram for how these traditions hold at least one thing in common. And that one thing is, how do we as human beings strive to be our best self? And there's an agreement from the very beginning, and the agreement can be found in Ahimsa Satya Asteya Brahmacharya Aparigraha. And the idea is that in order to live the good life, you have to live a good life. And that means that not going around killing things, not lying to people, not cheating people, not sexually abusing people, not just, and this is the great modernist, globalist, consumerist challenge, not just merely going around getting a lot of stuff, okay, that we need to work on a sense of how can we become our best self. And it starts with ethics. And it also includes meditation. And in the Jain texts, in the Buddhist texts, in the yoga texts, in the Hindu texts, we have very specific instructions about developing smriti, about developing mindfulness, about developing samprajñata, the ability to stick with a topic and focus the mind, and also to, regardless of where it lands within the vocabulary of a particular tradition, to be able to land in a place that the Advaitins call Nirguna Brahma, that the Jains refer to as ayoga, disconnection from karma, that the Buddhists call shunyata, that place of surrender and release. And those categories are shared in common. And at different points in history, scholars such as those that I've named, Haribhadra, Hemachandra, and later Yashavijaya, have lined up the parallels and said, I think we can get along on these issues.
It's really fascinating. I think I mentioned to you in a previous conversation that one of my favorite metaphors for teaching Indic religion is as a jungle, an ecosystem with all these various flora and fauna that correlate and cross-pollinate. It can be viewed as disparate, but indelibly interconnected at the same time. At the risk of oversimplifying, another sort of trope that comes to mind that I often share is this dharmic double helix. Like Dharma is obviously multivalent, complex, and dynamic over time, but there seems to be it's sort of bipedal. There's the Dharma of the outer life and the Dharma of the inner life. And when it comes to this Dharma of the inner life, by virtue of the precepts that you've named, really, there's so much overlap between what we may think of as heterodox or orthodox traditions. And I find that so fascinating. In terms of three of those specific precepts, moral precepts, you say something very interesting. I believe it was the concluding chapter of the book. In terms of three A's of Jainism, and without putting words in your mouth, perhaps what makes really what allows for this rich overlap between Jainism and yoga. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, and I also want to highlight from the book itself that we're dealing with modernity, and I guess we really live in post-modernity now, so that's certainly there. We're dealing with the antique. We're dealing with issues that come from long, long ago. And we're also going through a survey of how, over the course of centuries, interpretations morphed, how ideas changed, and how even vocabulary changes. And in the modern period, three words that begin with A have been lifted up just in the last 20 years by contemporary Jain thinkers that encapsulate for them the great contribution for the modern and postmodern period. And the first is the one most closely identified with Jain thought and practice, and that is ahimsa. This is nonviolence, the desire to do no harm. And with nonviolence, we have immediate connections that bring people into remembrance of not only Mahatma Gandhi, but Emerson and Thoreau, Quaker tradition from the West. And then we have this idea of the Jain monk, the Jain nun, taking this to an extreme. And what the lay leaders have done within Jainism is say, no, we need to teach our young people about how this is just the best way to live. The benefits of vegetarianism, which are now confirmed in all sorts of studies, the benefits of using one's words instead of just allowing the emotions to run crazy and wild, okay, that this is important. Number two, aparigraha, and aparigraha. Okay, graha means to grasp. Parigraha means to grasp a lot. And means to cease and desist. And for the Jain monks and nuns, they've perfected a lifestyle, and there are tens of thousands of Jain monks and nuns in India. They have perfected a lifestyle where they take only the minimum. And on the one hand, it's the most extreme commitment. It, on the part of Digambara monks and nuns, requires total nudity. It requires, regardless of gotch or of community, that you no longer cook for yourself. You only survive through food given directly, sometimes into your hands through the generosity of others. So that's like the most extreme religion we can ever imagine. And it becomes a way for lay people to reconsider their actual needs. So the frugality is rather significant within Jain tradition, as well as the philanthropy. So philanthropy becomes the remarkable gateway towards self-purification through adherence to apar vigraha. And in the United States, there is a project afoot, and it's almost halfway there within only 2-3 short years, of creating funded positions for the study of Jainism inspired by this principle of aparigraha. Then the third is the philosophical. And here we're, you know, sort of not in Ahimsa Satya Steya Brahmacharya Parigraha. We took the first and the last of those, and then we're doing Jain philosophy. And with Jain philosophy, they say, an ekanta. No one person can have the final word. No one view can account for all occurrences. So rather than saying Advaita, rather than saying, oh, it's not two, it's really all one, what Jainism asserts from really day one is that there exists a multiplicity of souls, and that every soul, every being holds a unique perspective, and that to adhere to ahimsa, we must give space for those perspectives within, of course, reason. But this commitment to the multiple is, I think, rather unparalleled, and I see it play out in the culture in so many different ways. And part of putting the book together was so exciting because we were able to include lots of different voices from different generations, from different methodological styles. And as you were saying about the metaphor of the jungle, is, you know, you can't understand what's going on in India without knowing some philosophy, without knowing how ritual works, without knowing the underlying ethics, without knowing the sociology of it all. So yeah, and the Jains are multivalent in their approach to knowledge.
Well, you've actually preempted my next question, which was essentially around the various types of projects we have. If you want to say a word in terms of how they're grouped or the trajectory or however you want to divide or describe them, but it'd be great to just touch on each so as to give listeners in various subfields using various methodologies sort of to give them a sense of the value of this volume.
Yeah, so about 70 years ago in India, actually probably 80 or 90 years ago, there was a move to create a wellspring for Jain studies. And many people, not necessarily of Jain birth, were recruited into academies and universities to translate and to really do philosophy from Jain perspective. And we were fortunate to include two of these scholars. One is no more, Sagarmal Jain, and Kamal Chand Sogani. And Sagarmal Jain from Parshma Vidyapeet in Benares, and Dr. Soghani from Jaipur University, Rajasthan University, were of the remarkable group of scholars like Natmal Tatya, who I had mentioned earlier, who had studied their Prakrit, who had studied their Pali, who had studied their Sanskrit, who grew up during the period of the British Raj, have impeccable command over the English language, better than my own command, and who were so elegantly trained in so many disciplines. And both of these scholars have chapters in this book that give us a sense of their comprehensive, long view knowledge. And in the case of Dr. Soghani, he was in direct conversation with William James and Evelyn Underhill, which just brought joy to my heart as I sat with Dr. Soghani, and I get to see him periodically even now. And what he's doing is constructive theology. And we were able to take his book from so many decades ago and bring the quintessence of it into this remarkable chapter that goes step by step through the yogas of Jainism from a universal perspective. Then we have other more contemporary scholars who have gone into, I'll say, the nitty-gritty of the philology. And Jayendra Soni, the president of the World Sanskrit Group, has written about how yoga gets used in the Tathagata Sutra, where, you know, it's really a yoga. You don't want yoga, you want getting rid of karma in the Tathagata Sutra. And he's very clear on that. Johannes Bronckhorst, similarly, taking a very granular topic on Sankhya and the soul vis-a-vis Kundakunda. And Kundakunda, a very early Jain philosopher who was giving voice to spirituality in a way akin to yoga, not quite using the word yoga, but in this way of examining, interrogating text and drawing connections. And similarly, from a philological point of view, we have Piotr Basilewicz from Poland, who looked at yogi pratyaksha. And in Jain traditions, going way back, you have to develop this place of vision called sarvajñā, which means that you really see everything, you become omniscient. And he unpacks that vis-a-vis normal perception and the possibility philosophically, can this really happen? Does the great Jain yogi truly know everything? And then in my own contributions to this, I sort of do a little bit of a blend of what the philologists have done and start to introduce some sociological categories and say, how can we understand what the tantricas were doing through the prism of Jain categories? And similarly, we have Uli Kwanstrom, Lund University, talking about yoga as expressed by Hemachandra some thousand years ago. And then we get into what we might call the early modern, the late medieval period. And Jeff Long, a great scholar, did his PhD at Chicago on Anekampada, on multiple viewpoints from Jain perspective, looks at Yashavijaya 200-300 years ago, writing extensive treatises on practices of Patanjali yoga vis-a-vis meditative practices and ethical practices within Jain yoga. And John Court, the great scholar and savant of all things Jain, has interrogated the Digambara hymns that, again, 300-400 years ago, a little bit earlier, a little bit more recent, call out for when will I find the great yogi? And the yogi becomes the trope for the accomplished acharya, the accomplished example of what is possible. And John is such a very fine translator that I really enjoyed hearing him when we were together in London, and then again reading what he has put together. And then I bring it completely into the contemporary. And there was a great scholar, Mahapragya, Acharya of the Tarapanti Svetambara denomination in Western Rajasthan, probably the largest single denomination of Jain monks and nuns today. And Mahapragya, going back to research in the 1970s and drawing from his relationship with Mr. Goenka, who had brought the whole mindfulness practice to the world as he had learned it in Southeast Asia, Mahapragya developed a system of meditation known as Praksha Dhyan. And this is now taught by Tarapantis all over the world. And we have two scholars, Andrea Jain, well known for her work on selling yoga and contemporary forms of yoga, but that book opens with the discussion of Praksha Dhyan. And then Smita Kothari, who did her PhD drawing from active participation in Praksha Dhyan camps in India. And then my final chapter includes my reflections on being with contemporary Jain teachers such as Mahapragya and Shiv Kumar Muni, who teaches a wonderful meditation. I've been on retreat with him where he takes that, it's almost like the Kena Upanishad, and Shankara and our wonderful friend Ramana Maharshi. And he has you sit for a good long couple of hours in the morning saying, Koham, 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 who am I? And then in the afternoon, you turn to Soham, that no, I really am the best self. So bring it right up into the moment and include descriptions of contemporary places of pilgrimage, as well as highlight these contemporary teachers, male and female, of Jain yoga today.
Who do you think might most benefit from or be interested in this volume, either in terms of subfields of the academy or in terms of folks, interested lay people? Who do you think this might be for?
Yeah, I think it's really for both. For scholars, it's an invitation to be playful, to take your language skills and just your observational skills and put them together. It's also for perhaps devotees of Praksha Dhyan who want to know the context for what they practice. And it's also for, in small doses, those who want just a general introduction to the spirituality of Jain traditions. And some scholars get so abstract and so speculative about argumentation that they might lose that texture that, no, this is a living, breathing practice. And I remember being with Padmanabh Jaini, who inspired so many of us. And the history of Jain studies is that Morris Bloomfield, who had famously translated the Rig Veda, had back, you know, more than 100 years ago, devoted himself to Jain narratives and taught two people who really didn't do, okay, W. Norman Brown was one of his great students who did some in Jainism, but didn't make it his focus. And the other was Mrs. Sinclair, who did her doctorate and then made this massive translation of Jain narrative literature some, you know, 80, 90 years ago. She never became a college professor. So it just sort of stopped. And it wasn't until Padmanabh Jaini, a scholar of Buddhism, published the book, The Jain Path of Purification in 1979, that the discipline arrived in the United States. and John Court did an early dissertation on jhana practice out of Harvard University. Now there are dozens, and there are so many openings for people that are qualified to teach jhanism. And I think that this book helps show a little bit of that history of connectivity and has in a way of approaching this that is methodologically diverse. And I think as a scholar that we all have to be open to multiple approaches.
I had the good fortune of hearing Padmanabha S. Janey speak a few times while at the International Summer School of Jain Studies. I believe this was 2008. It's just such a rich experience studying Jainism on the ground in its context. It's clear that in addition to being a fine scholar of Indic traditions, Jainism, Hinduism, yoga, however you want to call that ecosystem, it's clear that to me, anyhow, that embodied experience, lived tradition, is of value to you. Would you say a bit about that? I know we've talked about that in previous podcasts, but there may be a number of listeners who may not have caught that one, or it wasn't foregrounded in as it is now. But can you tell us a little bit about, in your view, the importance of direct embodied experience? Maybe both as a scholar and beyond, you know, as this is meant to be generative, not confining. So answer as you feel comfortable.
Yeah. I first want to lift up my positionality as a professor of theology. And that means from our mission statement of the university, we are very concerned with the service of faith and the promotion of justice. Not all universities have that intent. So I have been given free rein to look at faith in all of its manifestations. That's my job. And I've been also empowered in a very good way to consistently lift up issues of justice. And therefore, in the classroom, but also in the scholarship, there is something at stake that's far more than just going out and getting a job. And we have a great engineering school, we have a great film and television school, we have a great business school. And every single of those students has to do a mini minor in philosophy and theology, okay, regardless of discipline. So I come from the real world. And as a very young person, I got enthralled with what India opened for me. And I studied for many years with a woman from Calcutta, from the time of teenager through my early adult years, and committed my wife and I ourselves to a life of meditation and yoga. So this notion of abstracting or of othering or of somehow being an Orientalist about all this, I mean, that just was never part of my intention or part of my training. And what I think we need to keep in mind with this moment in history, which is, you know, we used to call it the information age. We don't even use that term so much anymore, because information is so 20th century and so 19th century and so Aristotelian. And with these machines, we can just put three words in and get all the information that we need from the computer. Okay, the machine does that. But what the machine cannot do is speak to the qualities of what it truly means to have a heart, what it truly means to be a human in the world. So that the task of education and the task that I think Padmanabhijani put in front of me, I invited him in the early 80s to come to Stony Brook, where I was then part of a research institute, to talk about nonviolence. And the challenge that he put in front of me was to go to India and put yourself in the presence of these monks and nuns. And these monks and nuns and scholars and exemplars, if you will, have a transformative effect. Yeah, they may inform you about one thing or another. And I love it in India because you want an answer to a specific question, and it's going to be not exactly what you had anticipated when you're given the answer. I mean, that's part of the beauty of what Amartya Sen labeled as the argumentative Indian. You know, this anekamvada is just sort of hardwired all through the culture, all through the grammar. I mean, there's a fully built out way to use a verb that means, well, it could be like this. And we've got to use a whole bunch of phrases to open up possibility, whereas it's hardwired into at least the Sanskrit language that, yeah, what you may think to be the case may not be the case. And this, again, I want to just emphasize that wisdom of Padmanabhijani. How do we show up in the world? Who do we choose to spend our time with? How can we become formed? How can we become transformed? And to me, that's the purpose of education and of scholarship.
That deeply resonates. It's probably why you are the only individual who's been on this podcast 3 times. Not that I haven't deeply enjoyed and learned from all of my guests, but that maybe is a great segue into putting on the radar of the listeners something that I hope we touch on before closing in, and we're about time for today. Part of my role at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies is facilitating the development of new courses. I'm on their course development board. These are all online courses, of course, which I tutor. And the question arises, what sorts of courses might be cool or interesting or useful or transformative or fruitful? And really there's great interest in Hinduism and ecology, you know, the overlap between Indic philosophy, ethics, and ecological concerns, environmental issues. And so I ended up approaching one Dr. Chris Chappell to see if he'd be interested in creating such a course for us. And such a course indeed is in the works. And so it'll be fascinating to see that course brought to fruition, because there's obviously the scholarly piece, but part of the criteria for seeking out a scholar is not just the breadth of scholarship or the status or the credentials that needs to be there, but the ability to speak to people on the earth about things that matter to them, the ability to leverage what we do at the academy for something that's meaningful and practical, to touch on partake in, or at least acknowledge the primacy of embodied experience in education, in Indic religion. And so so I'm happy that you agreed to do this course. And for those of you listening, hopefully within a few months' time, there'll be a brand new course at OCHS on Hinduism and the environment.
It's so wonderful that we're able to, through the computer, communicate globally and still have the comfort of our own place and feel that we're connecting with people that are so close and yet so far.
Well, certainly there's no travel time. Well, one of the boons. Yeah. All right. So is there anything else that you wanted to say about the publication or current projects before we close for today?
Yeah, I'd like to just give a shout out for the young people that are taking up these studies. And I see so many new scholars that are concerned about the state of the world and wanting to really make these connections between the ethical, the meditative, and the performative. And that's a good trend. I think we can be optimistic looking forward.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for speaking with me today about this book.
Thank you.
For those of you listening, we've been talking with Dr. Christopher Key Chapel, who is the Doshi Professor of Indic and Comparative Theology and the Director of the Master of Arts in Yoga Studies at Loyola Marymount University. We've been speaking with him about this really fascinating volume, Yoga in Jainism, just on point for this podcast, newly branded New Books in Indian Religions. Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the Indian juggle. Take care.